I started my organization, The Voice of Libyan Women, in 2011. I was 21 at the time. And the core focus of the organization in its initial stages was women's political participation and economic empowerment. So we started off with a women's charter project that we took nationally. And I quickly learned, and we had been using a lot of, you know, the UN declarations and conventions and CEDA and 1325 to really propel conversations. And I very quickly learned and was informed heavily that those were irrelevant in our community because our national laws had not been respected for 41 years. So why were they going to start learning about international law, which couldn't be respected? So we quickly began to reshift our focus, and we did it in two different streams. One stream was very high-level political, and it's actually what gave us enough legitimacy to do the grassroots, and I'll explain this in a second. But I'm 21. I was 21 at the time, not 21 anymore, and I had not been from the capital city. I was from a city called Zawiya, which is about 30 to 45 minutes away, but it is considered much more conservative. And at the time, the UN and the international community really were focused on the two larger cities in Libya. They had not come out to Zawiya. If they did, it would be to meet the local council for a couple of hours. But they definitely weren't meeting with civil society. And when they called on women's groups, we were not considered a women's group. We were young. And so when we talk now about youth, peace, and security, everybody talks about young men who they're worried will pick up guns. And when we talk about women's rights, everybody talks about older women who have influence networks, connect, you know, finances, support. And so young women tend to get left out. So our approach to this was to find them. And so I went to Tripoli and I waited in a hotel lobby that I had seen on the news as being where the UN was based. And I waited, and then I saw a group of older, middle-aged white men. And I was like, this is them. So I went, and I sat down, and I said, you know, this is our project. This is the work we do, et cetera. And they were excited about it. And I all the time think about if I had sat down with a different member of that group and they had been somebody who said, we're not interested right now, if I would be in the positions I am in now and have the role that I was able to play in Libya. And so from there, we did something called One Voice, and it was an international conference. At the time, Catherine Ashton, who was working with the EU, came and spoke. And in our second year, actually, Milan Verveer was our key speaker. And the idea was to be able to bring people who were working on the ground to Tripoli to meet with parliamentarians and the government and to actually sit around tables and solve problems together. So each day was dedicated. It was 5 days. Each day was dedicated to one thing. So one day would be economy. The other day would be religion and social change. And there would be politics. And then there was education and media. And the idea was to show not only the political players, but the other civil society, the ones who tended not to include the younger women, that we could convene them. That we were the ones who could bring everybody together, that we had a very key role to play. And so when it first happened, it was before Tripoli, it was a week and a half after Tripoli was liberated, November 11th, 2011. And the idea genuinely was that when people showed up, none of them knew we were the organization. People thought I worked for whoever headed up our organization. But everybody had been still talking about humanitarian efforts. Everybody had still been talking about conflict. And so we were the ones who really shifted the conversation into politics and policy and what are we going to push for and our constitution and our women's charter and women's inclusion in the media. And security was obviously one of those key components. And the reason I mention all of this, the reason I give this information is because we often attempt to say, well, we're going to work with only grassroots youth, or we're going to work with only, you know, the elite men who can sit around the table. And there's a key amount of strength in having all of those different voices there. Youth are not monolithic. In fact, youth are exceptionally fluid. I will no longer be youth, as my sisters remind me, in I think 4 years, I think 4 years. So I mean, we're not a static group. And that's often why there hasn't been a lot of inclusion of youth and a lot of movement for youth, because by the time somebody is included, they're past their youth age and they're working on something else. So I think we have to be very realistic about the challenges that exist. If we're going to be very, you know, genuine and organic about the inclusion of youth, we have to be talking about the spaces in which we've created. And that's what brings me to this youth bulge theory, which I will have to touch on. So I do a lot of my academic work is in securitization, and I'm sure many people here have heard of securitization. But securitization is a theory that the elite determine what is an existential threat to the community, and we see it play out with global health. We see it play out with extremism. We see it play out with very many things where something is afforded more priority. And actually allocated more resources to the detriment of other issues in society, which have actually led to that problem. And so a lot of this is cited under, you know, youth bulge is a securitization trigger. People say, well, there's so many youth, and if we don't give them something to do, they're going to kill us all. I mean, and the problem with that is it's completely theoretically unfounded. By empirical evidence, it's not the problem. The problem is actually something called relative deprivation, which is where if I see that you have more and better than me, even though I have worked as hard and I deserve as much, of course, it's going to create resentment. Of course, that's human nature. It's going to create resentment. And if I think that I am not being given because of my gender or my ethnicity or my race or superficial features which have been socially constructed, of course I'm going to fight against those structures, right? I mean, it's a very human concept. It's not about the number of youth, because if we were all actively employed and given the same opportunities and gotten to sit in the same parliaments and get to head up states, I mean, I think we would be a lot less concerned about us picking up guns. So the issue with youth bulge and the framework, the resolution being one of those resulting arms, is that a lot of them are built on this basis that youth are something we should be afraid of. A lot of them are built to counteract this, you know, notion that youth are dangerous. We have to have a resolution to include them in peace building because if we don't, you know, they might do something. And the problem therein is that we're not actually addressing any of the underlying issues. We don't end up talking about education. We don't talk about the legitimate concerns that youth have. We don't talk about employment. We don't talk about the fact that if we want youth to be included, we have to institutionalize their roles and their voices and their experiences, and they have to be given the same credibility and leverage and opportunity as those who are older. We don't talk about many of those things because we securitize it and we focus it on something as very superficial as countering violent extremism alone, as though you can address that without addressing all the underlying things which underpin it. And that's impossible. It's impossible. So youth and peace building, I think, is society building, really. We need to be talking about youth's inclusion in every space. We need to be talking about youth's inclusion in education, in media, in infrastructure. We need to be talking about youth everywhere, because the idea that we can somehow isolate it to one specific avenue is I think, very superficial and an oversimplification of our situation. The last thing I'll mention is the parallels between 1325, because I think it's important for us to recognize the challenges that may exist. And if it's already been done once, we know they exist. But I think the largest challenge is that it remains a piece of paper. Mm. And a resolution alone has its strengths. Obviously, if a resolution is founded in legitimate needs for a community, because Resolution 1325 was a paper I was able to use to get into meetings that I never would have been able to get otherwise with heads of state. So it was definitely key in the sense that it opened up a door. I could say, listen, you got to listen to me. You guys have signed on to this. But that was about it. That was it. There was no political support. There was no financial allocation. A lot of the member states that were in Libya, a lot of the international community had no idea what 1325 was, or if they did, they knew it in passing. But even they did not have enough knowledge for us to be able to actually translate it into some action on the ground. It took a lot of time and education, and we had to educate ourselves, the local civil society in many ways, around it. So for the kind of challenges that may arise, I think that's actually the greatest one, is it can be a piece of paper, but a lot of piece of papers come out of the UN that mean absolutely nothing to people on the ground. And it has to translate in a way which it does not rob people of their local dignity. It has them at the table for their experiences and the value they bring, not because we're worried they might pick up a gun. Mm.